You know how to book flights and hotels. All you're missing is a tool to plan the travel experiences you'll have once you arrive. That's why you need Viator. Book guided tours, excursions, and more in one place. There are over 300,000 travel experiences to choose from, so you can find something for everyone. And Viator offers free cancellation and 24/7 customer support for worry-free travel. Download the Viator app now and use code Viator10 for 10% off your first booking in the app. Find travel experiences for you. Do more with Viator.
When you visit Arizona, time is measured in moments, not minutes. Like the moment you see the Grand Canyon for the first time. Visit a new state of mind. Learn more at hereyouareaz.com.
I call it the Adam's Law of slow-moving disasters. Whenever you see a problem, or let's say society sees it, and you've got plenty of time, we always fix it. So you're going to run out of food. All right, we'll figure out how to grow more. Done. You're going to run out of oil. Well, we'll figure out how to frack.
What's up, ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls around the world? I would like to welcome you back to the Real Talk with Zuby podcast. Today's episode is going to be a very special one. We have a returning guest. Last time we recorded remotely, but this time we are doing it in person. And this is the one and only creator of Dilbert, author of many, many best-selling books, and just a brilliant, interesting, insightful mind. And this is, of course, Scott Adams. Great to see you, man. How are you?
Good to see you. Thanks.
Scott, I've done a brief intro there, and you've been on the show before, but for people who have been living under a rock for the last few decades, tell them a little bit about yourself.
Well, I created the Dilbert comic that was in 2,000 newspapers around the world for about 34 years. It's still running only behind the subscription walls now on X and on the Locals platform. But like you said, I also write books and do podcasting, podcast every day, Coffee with Scott Adams, and that's sort of my life right now.
That's awesome, man. Well, I don't want to go completely into all your backstory because we talked a lot about that the first time that we spoke. I'm curious to know, though, we were having a little bit of a preamble before we turned the cameras on, and we were just talking about 2024 and where we are in the world, and it sounded like you are pretty optimistic. So how is everything going for you?
Well, I'm super optimistic. I felt like last year, and of course the pandemic years were just, you know, terrible years. But it feels like even though a lot of stuff is broken in the world, you can see the force of correction forming. So, you know, I feel like there's enough force to get the border closed, you know, at least by the end of the year before we're all dead. I feel like GDP's growing enough that maybe we can get a handle on the ratio of debt to GDP. The AI stuff is insanely interesting. I think it'll change the kind of work people do, but I'm not sure people will work less. We'll see. That could be a wild card. But it's going to be a fun year of politics because there's just so much energy around it. And podcasting is going wild. The independent voices have more, let's say, more authority, more audience. And I just feel these huge correcting forces almost in every domain right now.
Yeah. What have been some of the lessons that you have personally learned for yourself or in your career over these last few years? Because you said earlier on when we were just talking off camera that it feels like you've been in a war for the past 4 or 5 years. So what's even been going on and what have you learned from that?
I'll tell you the biggest thing that happened to me, and I guess I learned something, is that when you're away from humans for that long or you know, very small group of people, it's really harmful. I mean, you really feel the health impact and the mental health impact of not being around people. Now, at my current age and my current, you know, non-married situation, I can go 2 to 3 days a week without any human contact. I don't mind most of the time. I'm always busy doing stuff I want to do, which is unusual. Yeah. I mean, I've never had that experience before. But there's also a loneliness epidemic, especially after a certain age. So that's a big problem. We gotta figure that out. And I think that's what I most learned about is the importance of your social interaction. Like, you don't feel it until you miss it. And then it's just a health problem, really.
Yeah, that's interesting, because it's one of those things that it's a given that we need social interaction. But I guess that all throughout most people's lives, you've always got it just by default.
Right.
So a bit like health itself, you don't really notice how great it is yeah. and how valuable it is and how you feel without it until it's gone temporarily, or yeah. let alone permanently. And then a lot of people all around the globe, to varying degrees, were put into a position for a very extended position amount of time where there were just different levels of isolation. How did that affect you personally?
Well, you know, in the pandemic, you can't really make friends. Mm. And then after the pandemic, I lost my social instincts.
Okay.
So at this point, there are plenty of people I can invite to do anything. There are other people who invite me. So it's not a lack of opportunity. I just don't know how to execute anymore. Mm. It's almost like a skill that I seem to have lost or atrophied. So whatever it is that makes you actually act to pick up a phone or text somebody and say, let's get together on Thursday, I know I would enjoy it, but I don't send the text. And that's different from my whole life. It's not like I'm shy.
Yeah.
So there's something that happened. Something broke in my social instinct, I guess.
That's interesting. That's very interesting. Is that something that you feel is coming back now?
No.
Okay.
And that's the scary part. If it were coming back, I probably would have treated it as temporary and not worth noting. But I actually feel like there's something permanently changed. Mm. And I'm a little bit worried about it, honestly.
Yeah. What's your greatest concern about that?
Well, if I spend too much time alone, it's just unhealthy and, you know, it's probably not good for anybody.
Our podcast today is sponsored by Tolos. One thing I've upgraded in my routine over the last 6 months is wearing barefoot shoes more often. As someone who's constantly on the go, whether training or traveling, the shoes I wear matter. Tolos sent me a pair of their Archetype 2.0 trainers a few months ago, and I've been wearing them regularly ever since. Tolos are not toe shoes, so they don't make you look like a weird ninja turtle. Instead, they have a wide toe box with flat, thin, flexible soles. It's enough to protect your feet, but not so thick that they weaken your feet like regular sports shoes. What I love about Tolos is they feel great, and they're some of the first barefoot shoes that I genuinely like the look of. They were created by a friend of the show who used to play professional hockey, and today they're being worn by pro athletes all around the world. They're a game changer both inside and outside the gym. If you'd like to try them while also supporting the show, you can get 10% off using my code Zuby at their website, weartolos.com. That's weartolos.com, WEARTOLOS, and use the code Zuby at checkout for 10% off your order. Tolos, feel for yourself.
So I think we have to talk about an elephant in the room, because you've been through multiple cancellations, some of them more imaginary, some of them more real. Over the last couple of years, of course, it was big news that the Dilbert comic strip got dropped from
everything.
It was very thorough. Over 2,000 different publications. So I assume that was the syndication. How does it work? Was it the syndication company just made a decision on that, or how does it work?
I thought I was safe because I had so many clients, so many different newspapers that carried it. I thought, well, even if a few canceled me, how bad could it be? But they went after the syndication company, and that's the choke point. So if the syndication company cancels you, you're gone out of all newspapers. So that happened. But also they went after my publishing company. So the books that were non-Dilbert books, as well as the Dilbert books, they were immediately taken out of print. So a huge catalog of my work just disappeared from the public.
And can you tell the story behind that? Because I'm not trying to do any type of gotcha. I'm just trying to understand what happened there. Because I remember the day. I remember the day where I think your name was trending on the app called Twitter at the time. And I think I was in the UK at the time, so I'm kind of seeing all the hubbub, but I'm sort of some hours behind what's gone on the previous day. And I'm like, wait, what's going on? And then I see a clip of you saying something that sounds a little bit crazy. So especially for the people who just saw that or heard that, but don't know any wider context, why you said it, what was meant, can you elaborate on that and just explain it?
Yeah, it was just about a year ago. So it was end of February last year. And the way the news tells it, I said something racist about black people. But let me give you the full context.
Sure.
First of all, for the benefit of the viewers, maybe you can confirm this. Have you ever seen a story about a public figure that was accurate?
Probably.
It's rare, though.
Yeah.
Yeah. If you're the subject of stories, as I have been for, you know, many years, I'll look at the story and I'll say, huh, they got like really basic stuff wrong. But usually it doesn't matter.
Yeah.
Like it's a publicity thing. You're selling a book. It's like, they got my name wrong. Doesn't matter. Spelled the book right. But in general, people writing any kind of news about celebrities, they're going to get lots of context wrong. So this one was completely ripped out of the context. The context that should have been there, and I would have added it if it hadn't blown up, so it took me a while to get back to it, is that in a world in which, at least in America, probably in Europe too, the victimization model of there are oppressors and there are victims, and you got your CRT and your DEI and your ESG, and they all collectively tell the story that there's some people in America who are the bad ones, mm-hmm. and I'm in that category. And the context was, if somebody is being trained by society, formally trained, to see you as the enemy, you should get as far away from them as you can. Because mm-hmm. if people see you as the enemy, they're going to act that way. And that's bad. Now, on top of that, if you're a white guy in America and you go out for a job in, let's say, corporate America, and you have equal or similar resume, you don't really have a chance in corporate America because they can get a twofer if they hire somebody who's a minority. So, if you're offering is a onefer, well, I can do the work, mm-hmm. but the next person comes in and says, I can do the work and I solve your other problem. It's not a good playing field. So strategically, if I were giving advice, I'd say, are you black or female or LGBTQ? Go toward corporate America. Mm. They love you. They're looking for you. They're going to really try hard to, make it work. If you're a white male in America, you might want to think of being an entrepreneur, maybe work for a relative or something, because mm-hmm. you're really going to be disadvantaged. Now, I'm speaking from experience. My first corporate job was at a bank. And one day my boss called me in and said, I don't know how to tell you this, but the word came down from senior management that we can't promote white men anymore. And I said, what? Yeah. Seriously? Is that a real thing?
And this was in the 90s, right?
Yeah. And they said, yeah, and we're telling you directly. We're not hinting at it. Mm-hmm. They told us we're in trouble if we promote you. So I was finishing my MBA at the time, and they promoted my coworker who had a high school education. And this is banking.
Yeah.
I was working on an MBA, and I had a degree in economics. So that was my first experience. Like, we're not really similarly skilled. Mm. There was a pretty big gap there. So I left. I was like, okay, I'm not going to put up with this. So I went to the phone company, and I got put on the fast track. Like, they identified me as a future executive. And one day, after a few years of that, and things were looking good, and I was, I was checking all the boxes, and I finished my MBA. It looked like I was going to be in senior management one day. My boss called me in his office, and again, said the exact same thing. We got caught with no diversity in senior management. We got to fix it. The press is all over us. And until further notice, we can't promote you because you're white and male. Mm. And I said, really? So wherever I go, my next job would be the same thing, right?
Did you ever think of becoming trans?
I briefly considered transitioning. That's the best career advice I've gotten. Thank you. So that's when I started working on Dilbert.
Okay.
Because I thought if I do something that doesn't have a boss, that could work out. And then that did work out. Mm. And then I got a TV show. Dilbert was briefly animated TV show on the old UPN network. It ran on Monday night, and it did well enough to be renewed. The second year, UPN decided that they were going to turn Monday night into an all-African-American block, comedy block. So Dilbert didn't fit there, so it got bumped to a different night. And in the world of TV, most TV people will tell you that if you lose your time slot, you usually get canceled soon after. Because once you've developed a little audience, they're very habit-driven. So I ended up getting out of the TV business because we lost our audience then. So in the context of getting employment, you've got an extra challenge if you're a white male, if you're in a diverse situation because of the need for DEI and diversity. If, you know, basically, you know, anything you say gets treated a little bit harsher depending on who you are. Mm-hmm. So you've got a free speech problem that's a little bit harder. So the basic idea is that it's not about individuals. It has nothing to do with any specific person, any black person, anybody's genes. None of that is part of the conversation. It is purely the system. So the part that when I say that public figures, the news is always inaccurate, the way the news reported it, it sounded like I don't like black people.
Yeah.
Is that what it kind of sounded like?
Oh, for sure. Yeah, it sounded like that to me. And I've got a pretty high bar. I'm not in the call everything right. and everyone racist crowd.
But that's what it sounded like.
I was like,
right?
Ooh. I'd had you on my podcast before. I've been following you for years, whatever. I was like, ooh, that was a bit of a, that was a strong one there.
Yeah.
What was that about? That was my initial.
Now, I was also trying to shock.
Okay.
So I was trying to make everybody go, my God, you can't say that. What are you saying? You bastard. I'm sorry. It slipped out.
It's okay.
So I was trying to get people riled up to draw their attention, which is a process I've used quite a bit in podcasting. First, I'll say something provocative, then I'll get people's attention, and then I'll fix it. Because once you're paying attention, I'll say something like I just said, and people go, oh, yeah, I guess that would be hard for you to, you know, get employment if you're fighting against diversity goals as well.
Yeah.
So there's not much there that's actually provocative. I'm not aware of anybody who's disagreed with me yet. But if they tell it out of context, it sounds like, man, that guy hates black people. I've never hated a black person in my life.
Yeah.
I've never had a bad experience, even once.
Yeah.
In fact, most of the crimes I've been subjected to are all white people.
Yeah.
Like I've been robbed several times at gunpoint. All white people.
Why do you think there's so much, to this day, I kind of find it nutty that it's 2024 and I still have conversations about race. Sometimes it makes my own eyes internally roll. But one big difference I notice being from the UK versus when I'm in the US is that the USA is a lot more racialist.
Right.
I'm not saying racist, but racialist, meaning right. that the way people view things and frame things and speak, the lens of race is used much more than it is, for example, in the UK. The example I often use with my American friends is, in the UK, we don't use prefixes with the word British very often. So no one would say that I'm African British or I'm black British. You don't have, oh, he's Asian British. He's white British. It even sounds strange.
Right.
But in the US, black American, Jewish American, African American, white American, Latino American, it's just in the terminology. It's in the media. It's in the books. People's just everyday language is a lot more racialized. And it seems like from a young age, I understand that obviously there's historical context to this, but it's like people are brought up to see it and focus on it a lot more than they are, for example, in the UK or from my understanding in Canada. So what are your thoughts on that? And do you think that's something that is useful or necessary, or do you think that's something that people should strive to get past?
Well, I think there's a lot of people looking for advantage, basically. So if you can carve out yourself as a victim and you say, I'm one of these, whatever that is, then you can get some economic advantage or social advantage. So I think it's mostly just people pursuing some kind of advantage. Mm. But to your point about you know, black American, whatever American, I like adding the American part because that's the important part. Mm. And if somebody else is going to bring up the category, I always add an American to it to bring it back to, you know, the core.
Yeah, it's interesting because I think with what I find concerning is, I think a lot of people have found concerning with what they call the woke left or DEI or critical race theory, whatever terminology people want to use to discuss this narrative is it seems like a regression in terms of thought, in terms of society, culture, politics. From my understanding, when I look at human history, or I look at even just at the history of the U.S., the big problem for a long time was the collective racial narratives. It was the fact that, oh, we're not going to see people as individuals and treat them as such. These are white people. These are black people. These are whatever. So different laws, different social standards, different rules for different people. And that was obviously a problem for a long period of time. And then it seems like, let's say from the 60s, 70s, 80s, 90s, even 2000s in particular, that was all getting better and better. And it seems like starting early, midway through the 2010s in particular, in a very mainstream fashion, that's when you started getting the, oh, no, colorblindness is bad. Oh, no, you must see race. Oh, no, you actually should treat people differently based on their skin color. And it was this strange inversion that happened in the name of, you know, by people who call themselves progressive, who are then saying that, oh, no, you're a bad person if you don't go by this victim hierarchy and this oppressor versus victim narratives across all of these different ways. And it seems in that sense, people have gone backwards over the past decade.
Yeah. I'm not sure why exactly. Does anybody know why, other than there's financial incentive for some people to get people riled up? I mean, I can't think of another reason other than the financial incentive of people who have influence.
I think there's a financial incentive. I think there's a social incentive with whatever victim narrative it is. I think there's now a lot of social currency and clout in claiming that you're some type of victim. And I think it's interesting that no matter what demographic you fit into, there's kind of a narrative for you that you can push, which has some kernel of truth in it, but then it's sort of expanded so high. And obviously if you have a victim, you have to now have an oppressor. So there's always going to now be another collective group who is the collective enemy. And all of these narratives are just flying out there. I think another reason why it's appealing to some people is because I think it acts as a permanent alibi. I think victim mentality allows you to outsource your locus of control. So let's say, for example, if I'm a black man, and if I internalize and vocalize the belief that the whole system, all the institutions and structures and a large percentage of the population are against me, and that we do live in this system of white supremacy, systemic, institutional, structural racism. I've got to work, 10 times as hard as other people to get the same thing. Other people are going to mistreat me. White people are my enemy, whatever all these narratives are. I don't believe all these, but if I did, then I have a weapon to smack other people with, which gets me social points, right? I can just go around name calling and I get respect and shout outs for it instead of people telling me I'm being a jerk. But also I have a very simple excuse for any of my own failings. If I behave poorly or I do something wrong, whether it's egregious or it's minor, or I just fail in my career, or I don't get a job position, I get declined from a university, whatever the case may be, I can always fall back on that alibi. Yeah. I can say, oh, see what it's like, guys? This happened to me because I'm a black man.
Yeah, we're such imitators that if anybody's using a technique that works, it's, you just want to use it. So if you see somebody saying, well, I got discriminated against, it's just such a habit to say, well, maybe I got discriminated against. Mm. So you get just primed to think of it that way. So my take is that if we teach people success tools, then all of those things won't matter.
So you've written multiple books about success tools, what it takes to achieve success. For people who are listening to this podcast, what are some of the core things that you think people should know that they don't when it comes to that topic?
Well, if I were giving some young person success tips, I'd start with the basics. I'd say if you stay in a jail, don't do drugs, pay attention in school, learn some manners, you're about 60% of the way there. Mm. Then on top of that, the most important thing is what skills you develop that have a, you know, an economic value. And specifically, I talk about a talent stack, a stack of skills that work well together. And we talked a little bit before we went live here. And I use you as an example, actually. When I talk about it, I often will use you as my example. And not to embarrass you, but I've been watching your career for a long time. And I love what you've done in assembling skills. So, you know, first of all, you nailed fitness, which I tell everybody, you got to get fitness right, right? Get your body right, because that's your instrument. You can't do anything without that. Then you've got, you know, musical abilities, you're doing podcasting, you know, your social media skills are crazy. So you've developed a set of skills that are not just good individual skills, but they're really designed to work well together. And so that's, and it works. Now, in my case, I'm probably not the best artist, you know, in any room, actually. I'm not even the best. If you put 100 people in the room, 3 of them will be better artists than me. And 3 of them will be funnier than me. But there won't be anybody in the room who can draw as well as me and be funny. So it's the combination of being, you know, in the top 20% of skills that really work well together. That's what makes you magic. So, you know, the crew here that they can't see on camera, they're going to have to know, you know, lighting and various cameras and sound and, you know, it's a whole bunch of skills that makes you valuable. So if you're not putting together a collection of skills and you're just working on being good at one thing, that can work.
Yeah.
Like you could be a doctor, you could be a lawyer, but if you're a lawyer with an MBA or you're a doctor who specializes in something, you know, 2 skills, you're in much better shape.
You talked a little bit about AI beforehand and how you think that's going to shift how we work, how many people work, and so on. I mean, I'm curious to get your overall sort of takes and predictions about AI, but I'm thinking specifically with what you're saying is, do you think having those type of talent stacks is going to be something that's perhaps even more important as things like artificial intelligence become more common and able to replace some of those individual skills, but perhaps not the full talent stack?
Yeah, I'm concerned that all advice for career or success will be completely irrelevant with AI. Now, we're not there yet, but you could easily imagine it in 5 years or even 2, really. Yeah. So I'm doing now the same thing I did at the dawn of the personal computer age. I was working at a bank then, and we got the first personal computers in my little department because we were doing budget stuff. We needed them. And I said, I'm going to learn as much as I can about this computer thing because I know that it'll help me in like 50 different ways. So I learned to program, et cetera. And I can't tell you how many ways that's helped me, just understanding, you know, how technology works and knowing how to code, et cetera. So if I were giving advice, I'd say take a day a week and just do a deep dive on all the different apps that are coming out to find out really what AI can and cannot do. Because that's how you're going to find your spot. For example, I tried using AI for editing, and there's a bunch of different ones. And I thought, oh, I'll just find the one where I tell it what to do. Well, not even close. You're not even close. The human part is still 80% of it. You know, it's magic what the AI can do with videos and audios and stuff. But you still have to be there to say it was right or wrong. And I suspect the thing that the computer won't be able to do, the AI, is it won't be able to rapidly judge whether it did it right per what a human being wanted it to do. So it doesn't have the zeitgeist, the sense of culture or any of that. So it's going to be people telling the AI whether it did it right and try again. And I don't know when that ends. I mean, maybe there's a day when the AI even knows what we want and we don't have to give it specs. But how is it going to know it did it right? I feel like there's always going to be a place for that. But it's a narrow place. I mean, I would spend as much time learning AI as I could just to have as many options as possible.
Yeah. It's one of those areas I don't worry about that much. I don't worry that much about many things that other people worry about. But when I think of the sort of trajectory and future of humanity, AI is definitely one of the things that concerns me more than it excites me. And I think it's because I think it accelerates a lot of things that we already are massively struggling with. And we, so I, when I think of technology, I like technology. I'm a computer science graduate, but I'm like, we have not even come close to mastering smartphones. We have not mastered social media. We have not. And it's kind of like we've got these brand new problems that already exist. And then you're now just throwing in every couple of years, here's another technology, here's another technology. And I think with this one, given the actual capability to replace human jobs and work, there's already a crisis of meaning, a crisis of purpose. You hear a lot of talk, right, particularly with young men and young women. They're struggling to even know their place in the world, find their usefulness and so on. And then you're bringing in another technology that's going to make that even more difficult. And that's the angle I do worry about.
Well, the AI should largely replace a lot of smartphone stuff. So my idea is that the smartphone will be a blank screen. And if you want to type, you just start typing. And then the AI thinks, oh, this looks like it might be a text message. So it starts framing it that way. But you're like, no, it's going to be an email. And it gives you a choice. And it sort of just figures out what you're doing. Yeah, so you don't need to open an app first. The worst part about the smartphone is the flow. It makes me crazy that I'm like, I want to do a thing. Okay, what's the name of the app? Where's the app? Update the app. Get my, you know, the flow just is just insanity making. But if I can say to my AI, hey, I want to, you know, book a reservation or something, and I'm just talking to it, that's a whole different flow. I'm done. I just told it what to do and walk away. So I think our mental health could be a lot better simply because we're going to take a whole bunch of complexity and turn it into just saying what you want. And now your brain is free to go somewhere else. Because there's a whole bunch of problems that happen from being overwhelmed. And AI has the potential to remove detail from what we do. Like for me to do anything, I need 4 different apps, 3 different devices, a phone call, 3 passwords. Like none of that will be important.
Yeah.
The AI will just know who you are. It'll go get the resources you need and go do the thing. So taking all that away will either make us feel useless and like we don't know what we're doing with our free time, or it'll be so freeing that it'll be the best thing that ever happened.
Yeah, it's interesting. I think it's such a double-edged sword. I mean, one of my big predictions over the next couple decades is I think we're going to just see a lot of bifurcation in humanity. I think that we're going to, people already talk a lot about income gaps and wealth gaps. That's done to death over the centuries. But I think we're going to have increasing mental health gaps, physical health gaps, capability gaps, attention gaps. Remember, because I'm looking at lots of young children being raised right now, and some of them have got great parents who have their heads screwed on and who can manage these things and teach them certain things and show them how to manage it all, even socialize them in a healthy way so that they can look people in the eyes and have conversations like we're having right now. And then you're also going to have millions, hundreds of millions, maybe billions of young children who are just not raised with some or any of that.
Right.
And I don't know if they're going to be able to even do something as simple as what we're doing now, sit down and have a conversation with someone face to face, look them in the eye, know to how to just be socially calibrated and coordinated. I mean, you said at the beginning, just from having some time off after a lifetime of doing it for decades, even you taking some time off, you found, oh, it's a little bit hard to do this again.
Yeah.
And I'm imagining someone growing up almost never having done that. Maybe they've done it, you know, they know how to type on their thing and they know how to use the tablet or whatever, but they've just have not learned those core skills and they don't have even an attention span. Attention already is, there's quite a bifurcation going on there where one thing I love about podcasts is I get the long attention crowd. So to even be able to listen to this conversation, I'm already filtering for people who are capable of listening to long form content. And it's one of the reasons why there's multiple reasons I don't use TikTok, but I don't like the 20-second, 30-second video format, actually. I know that a lot of people are drawn to it and billions of people are watching TikTok and Reels and all these things, but kind of like, man, I don't know if I want to program my audience for this and recruit an audience which is just expecting and anticipating 20, 30 second clips of me saying a thing or you say something on the podcast. I think it's a concern that many, many people are getting wired to that type of content to the point that you then try to give them a book and they're like, this is boring. Or you try to send them a long form podcast and they're like, this is boring. They can't get through it.
So this is coincidentally like the perfect topic to tie together those other topics. So there's now an AI that will take your long form and it will on its own figure out the viral clips from it. So you can have both. There's a lot of stuff that we've had to choose. It's like, well, I can put my resources to do this or this, but AI will let you just do all of it with the same amount of work. It'll just do the hard parts for you. So, you know, it may be that combining the long form and the short form is just automatic, and that's maybe a month away.
Yeah. I mean, I do it already. I do have short form content out there. I'm just worried about people who it's like people who get completely accustomed to junk food.
Yeah.
And then they don't even enjoy the taste or the look or the smell of real food because they're just, hey, this is what I eat. I eat junk food all the time. And it rewires your brain and your expectations to think, okay, this is food. And then you give them the real thing and they don't like it. And I think this is just it's a new problem. I think one of the biggest challenges of, I guess, my generation and the generations coming is that we're facing a lot of new problems simultaneously. So I was having a conversation with someone recently just talking about, for example, the rising obesity rates. So I think the US is now up to about 39%, 39-40% of adults are obese. That's never been the case before. That's totally new in human history. The problem before was always starvation, malnutrition, not enough to go around. And so we have this new problem, and it being a new problem means that it's never been solved for at scale before. And all the incentives are trending in a direction for that 40% to become 45%, 50%, and so on. So even with something that is that simple, let's say, again, I see that bifurcation potentially happening where even in terms of health, 50 years from now, you'll have a percentage of the population that's in reasonable good health in the way that most people have been for the past many decades, and then a majority who are just obese and diabetic and are having mental health issues and so on. I don't want that to be the case, but well, I just look at the numbers.
I can solve
that
for you. Okay. Would you like to solve Please the do. Obesity problem
Let's go.
For you?
Let's go.
Yeah. It, just as a public service, I thought I'd solve Please. This. So I think we tend to think that the reason people are obese is because they eat too much. Yeah. And we're like, oh, but if you look at a video from like, let's say the early 1900s, every once in a while, you'll see an old video that's restored and 100% of the people are fit.
Yes.
100% every age. Mm-hmm. Now, none of them overate, like none of them had, you know, could have gotten fat. So here's what I discovered. I recently reduced my diet to only real whole foods that don't have any preparation to them, like a piece of broccoli steamed or a fish, and just stay away from the sauces and the wheats and stuff. And because I had an inflammation problem, I was trying to isolate it. So it turned out for me, getting rid of wheat in my diet, I don't know if it works for everybody, but got rid of my inflammation. Everything was good. But here's what I discovered. I eat all day long as much as I want. I lost 10 pounds while I was doing it. And you can't get fat if you don't eat processed foods. So if you're not eating things that somebody, you know, put together in a manufacturing plant, you actually can't get fat.
Can I jump in and say you definitely can? Because that's how sumo wrestlers gain weight.
Oh, okay.
Sumo wrestlers don't eat processed food. They just eat huge amounts of good, healthy food, but so many calories that they still gain weight.
I will accept the exception. Exception accepted.
Okay.
Yeah. So basically, here's my recommendation. You should try a couple of weeks where you just hold yourself to really boring foods, just a vegetable, a fruit, a piece of meat of some kind, whatever you eat. And watch what happens. I did this experiment with my audience. I said, you know, just voluntarily take 2 weeks, just eat clean, see how you feel. And oh my God, a week later, people are saying, I'm completely different.
Oh yeah.
Like my entire, everything is different. My attitude, I lost 2 pounds this week. It is actually that simple.
Yeah.
And then the most important part that, and you brought up earlier, the sort of the addiction to the taste, the sugars especially. What I found is that you can drop any addiction to a specific food in 2 months. So I drank up to 12 Diet Cokes a day for, I don't know, 30 years of my life or more. I mean, just insane amounts. Yeah. So I was addicted, like really, really addicted. Mm. And I stopped and it was hard. But what I did was I only stopped one thing.
Okay.
I never denied myself anything else in any other realm. I'm just not going to do that one thing. Mm. So I'd eat, you know, drink more coffee or something. And 2 months later, the most delicious, addictive thing I'd ever put in my mouth, a Diet Coke, I would look at it and I would say, that doesn't even look like a beverage.
Mm.
That looks like a chemical.
Yep.
Like my mental process in 2 months turned it into garbage.
Yes.
Yeah, I just wouldn't even touch it. I haven't had a drink, not a single sip. And then I said, well, that was really no problem at all, so I'll just pick another one. So I used to eat a lot of Snickers candy bars. And sometimes I get up to like 3 of the big ones a day. I was just crazy. And so I just, all right, that's the only thing I can't have. Mm-hmm. And I'd eat like crazy. I'd always be full. And then I lost that craving. And then, you know, a few months later, I'd say, just to see. And I'd be like, why did I ever like it? Mm-hmm. So it turns out that these things you think are your food preferences are not. They're actually assigned to you from the outside. If you're left to your own devices, you will lose those preferences. And by the time you're only eating good food, by the time you put a little butter and some, you know, pepper on a piece of broccoli that you steamed, it's delicious.
Yeah.
Yeah. Where it used to be boring.
Yeah. I agree with all this. I've written a book, Strong Advice on Health and Fitness, and even a children's book on health and fitness. So I know how to solve this at the individual level. I've known this for decades. I've been in the world of, you know, bodybuilding, powerlifting, strength training, you know, the bro science is always many years ahead of the real science. But, my question, and the answer might be that it's not possible, but I don't know how you implement that solution at scale. So if you're looking at the USA, if you're looking at a nation of over 300 million people and the numbers are trending in the way that they are, that advice that can be an individual listening to this is like, cool, I'm going to try that. Or they read my book. Cool. I'm going to try that, whatever. And it'll work for them. I don't know. Is that scalable? Is there a way that you can put that across hundreds of millions of people?
The way I try to make it scalable is to take it down to the simplest step.
Okay.
Because if you say to somebody, all right, you're going to lose weight, you're going to come up with an exercise routine that you've never done before, and you're going to eat things you don't like, and it's going to hurt every day. Nobody wants to do that. So I say instead, what's the one food you'd like to deal with? How about you eat as much as you want of everything else until you lose the craving for just the one thing?
Mm-hmm.
And if that works, do a second thing and then just keep going. Because it's not a sprint. You're trying to learn how to eat for the rest of your life.
Mm-hmm.
So if you treat eating as a system, this is the other thing I teach for success. Instead of having a goal, I'm going to lose 10 pounds, you should have a system. And here's an example. It doesn't have to be this one, but one of my systems is I don't keep anything in the house that's bad for me.
Yep, that's a good one.
Because I would definitely reach for it.
Yep.
So that's my system. It just can't get to it. The other thing is I continuously learn how to prepare foods that I like to eat. So, for example, I learned that if I cut a ripe avocado and just put a little soy sauce and pepper on it, it's not just good, it's delicious.
Yeah.
Now, that's perfectly healthy. So one thing at a time, I just go through and say, all right, I wish I could eat more of this kind of food. What is something I can do with this that would make me want to eat it? And then you bank that. All right, now I know what to do with broccoli. Now I know what to do with this, fish. And you just build on that forever until you have a body of things that you love because you've learned how to love them.
Do you think there's anything that should be done on a public health level, governmental level, big food level, big pharma level, anything like that to assist in this regard?
Yeah, you know, the government probably is helpless because, you know, big food probably has a lot of control over, okay, over the government. But I would love to see somebody like an RFK Jr. or somebody try to do a national experiment similar to what I'm saying.
Yes.
Just go 2 weeks without junk food and you tell me how you feel.
Yeah.
It's up to you. Like, there's no coercion. It's voluntary. But talk to your friend who went 2 weeks and see what they did. Mm. They're going to be really happy about it. And just kind of crawl your way through it a little bit at a time. It's the small bites of the process that make it work.
Yeah. If you're going to have the government apparatus in the way that there currently is, I think there should absolutely be like a, there should be a fitness minister. There should be some, not some, and someone who's actually in shape and knows their stuff. Not, I mean, in some countries you've got public health officials and they've never stepped foot inside a gym or eaten a salad, but someone who's, I don't know, some bodybuilding bro or powerlifter bro or former athlete who really knows their stuff and who can be some type of figurehead motivator to just, I don't know, get the country moving.
Yeah, you know, Arnold Schwarzenegger was that for,
yes,
for who? Was that under Hillary Clinton?
I'm not sure, but yeah, I recall that vaguely. What was his actual role? Do you remember?
I don't. I remember he was just going around telling kids to exercise more.
Yeah.
Which
it's a start. Useful. Yeah. It's a start.
It's a start.
Yeah. Shifting gears a little bit. I mean, you already had a big name for yourself, but you made a bigger name for yourself when you were talking in 2015 and 2016, far ahead of anyone thinking that it was possible for Trump to win. You were calling it out. You were saying, hey, this guy's got a 98% chance of winning when everyone else was saying he has a 0%. 2%, not 2%, 0% chance of winning. Number one, how are you able to foresee that? Yeah, let's ask that question first. How were you able to foresee that? And then I'm curious to get into where you think things are going to be going in 2024.
So when I was in my 20s, I became a hypnotist. So I actually went to school to learn how to be a hypnotist. And I got interested in it because my mother had gave birth to my younger sister while under hypnosis, and she didn't feel pain, she said, and didn't take any drugs for pain relief. So that impressed me. So when I was old enough to decide to take a hypnosis class, I did. And when I started watching Trump in 2015, I noticed the techniques of persuasion that he might call negotiating or sales or something like that. But he had all the tools. And I said, oh, my God, I've never seen anybody with all the tools before. And if he keeps doing this, there's no way he can be stopped. Because what I saw was Godzilla. Mm. Like, I saw a monster who couldn't be stopped, but only because I could see his toolbox. If you thought he was just talking and he was just saying random things and being provocative, you'd miss the whole story. Mm. He always uses a technique of making you think past the sale. He speaks in visual language. He keeps it simple. He repeats because repetition's, you know, half the game. And he amuses and he provokes and he takes all the energy out of the room until you forget anybody else existed. Mm-hmm. Now I literally did. I wrote a book about his technique. You know, there's so much to it. You could actually write the book. And so I asked him about it. I got to meet him.
Okay.
And
when was that?
2018.
Okay.
He was just sort of working his supporters, I guess. I got invited to the White House. And I asked him, you know, did he learn it or pick it up naturally or whatever? And one of the things we talked about was his minister in his church when he was a kid wrote the, I'll forget the name of the guy. But he was the most persuasive author in the world who was also a minister. So every Sunday, Trump sat in the church and got the best persuader in the world. They would listen to for an hour and probably just picked it up that way. Mm-hmm. It's my guess that that had a big influence on him. And he did say it had a big influence on him.
That's interesting
experience.
So, you know, we have to talk about it. 2024 is an election year in the USA. What are your predictions? What do you think is going to happen?
Well, you know, a lot could happen between now and then. Of course, there will be plenty of surprises. We hope everybody, you know, stays alive and healthy. That would be the first thing. But if there are no big surprises, and I guarantee there will be, so this is a straight line prediction that's never right. you know, if nothing changes, but of course it will, Trump should win because Biden is failing and people are seeing it. And the border is such a crisis that I just think people need to get that fixed before they can think too much about other things. And he offers that. So that's the, let's say, the path that's illuminated. Mm-hmm. But things that can knock it off the path is everything that Trump says ever.
Yep.
You know, every time he speaks, who he picks for his vice president could move things. If Biden decided to drop out before the election, that changes everything. Mm-hmm. And we assume the primaries will end with Trump versus Biden unless something changes this big. So I think it's going to be close because it always tightens toward the end, no matter what it looks like now. And I hate to bring it up, but the real question of whether we have a fair election is on the table. Mm-hmm. And I've never seen any confirmed evidence that anything was rigged in the past. So I have no evidence of that whatsoever. And I'm aware that no courts have shown that it was rigged in any big way. However, we don't have a system that you could know that for sure, because we don't have an auditable system. Mm-hmm. It's auditable in parts, you know, but let's say once the bits get into the machine, I don't know what the code is doing with it. I don't know if my vote got there. I don't know if the ballot that I filled out and dropped in a mailbox, I don't know if it ever got counted. So there's a whole bunch of holes in our system. And then I look at this context and I say, in the last few years, we've figured out that literally every system is corrupt, from our officials taking bribes to, you know, the FDA, to everything that happened during the pandemic. You know, all the most trusted institutions failed us, lied to us, and even are saying they lied to us now, you know, the people we trusted. What are the odds that every American system is corrupt except all 50 state elections? Mm-hmm. That's what we're told, that they're the exceptions to the system, and not just one exception. There's 50 of them.
Yeah.
And they're all pristine. Now, not pristine, but not problematic enough to change a result. I think it's going to be a huge trust problem, because whoever wins, the other side is going to say it was rigged.
Yeah, that's interesting. I mean, how does that make you think or feel about the past? Does it make you ever think that, wait, my whole life, has this whole thing been, has it been this way forever?
My current thinking is it's been this way forever.
Yeah.
And that we're actually smarter. Mm. So we're seeing the signals of the deceit, and, you know, we just have more tools, basically. I think back in the old newspaper days, you know, when people just got their news from the news, there were several billionaires who influenced the news and could get us into a war or out of a war, and it probably wasn't that different.
Yeah. One of the things that concerns me, and I don't know, I guess this is not really a new problem. Maybe it is when it comes to the artificial intelligence aspect. But one problem I foresee, even just for people's mental well-being, let alone things like politics, is the way that it's increasingly difficult to know what's real and what's true.
Yeah.
And I get this feeling, I mean, you talk about this a lot, right? You talk about the two different screens, right, which is that there are essentially multiple different realities that people are operating in. It's not as simple as people having different opinions. People have always had different opinions, different beliefs, but it's like alternate realities and dimensions that it seems like people are living in sometimes. And then they're unable to communicate, and it's very difficult for anyone to know, okay, what's actually true? What are the facts? If we can agree on the facts, we can then talk about our opinions. But it's just getting to a stage now, even to the point where with artificial intelligence now, you can see a visual, you can see a photo, you can see a video, you can hear audio, and it's like, wait, is that real?
I've reposted two fakes already in the past month.
Okay.
Now, I, of course, learned they were fakes and took them down. But I got fooled twice by AI.
Is this images or?
I think it was both images.
Okay. Yeah.
And I'm really keyed into fakes, you know, even before AI, because I've been fooled before. But it got me twice. And I thought, oh, my goodness, this is out of control. Because I feel like I may be one of the ones who are better at picking out fakes.
It's scary.
And it just got me flat. So, yeah, it's gonna get worse. We do live in two worlds. I just recently sent a message to a friend of mine who's a big anti-Trumper type. And I said, you know, do you know that if you're not following the news on X, you're probably completely in the dark. And it's not that everything in the other news is wrong. It's that they'll show you one side. And X almost always invites both sides, at least in the comments. And I said, so make sure this year you'll be in real bad shape because the news business is going, you know, right to hell. So make sure you're on X, in addition to whatever you're watching, to really give. And I got an answer like, I thought I'd traveled back in time. X is going to be all garbage, and the New York Times has good reporters, and they research it. So you have to use credible sources, Scott. Why are you? And I thought, oh my God, have I gone back in time? Like that made sense sometime in the past, but it's totally wrong, you know, in 2024. So that was a real shocker. And then every time I watch Sam Harris talk, I say, well, there's a brilliant, well-informed guy, but we live in a whole different world. My reality just doesn't match his reality at all. Mm-hmm. And then I have to ask myself, if I'm being intellectually honest, is a problem on my end? Because if you don't ask that, you're not playing fair. I feel like the problem's on his end, but I don't know, because wouldn't he know? Like, how would I know if the problem's on my end?
Yes.
If I think he doesn't know and he's smarter than me. So why wouldn't he know? So that's the part that really throws me, is not knowing when I'm wrong.
So something I notice a lot in the culture war discourse, political discourse, and all of that, and I think a lot of this is a function of social media, but a lot of people are afraid all the time. There's so many different doomsday narratives that are out there. Regardless of someone's belief system, there's the doomsday narrative, right? It could be worried about climate change over here and the climate apocalypse even. The language has gotten more intense over time. Or you've got people who are worried about, or the whole idea of, you know, Trump being an existential threat, right? Threat to democracy. Democracy is on the line. And then on the flip side, you know, it's the, you know, the left is doing this, and of course the whole border situation, and this is going to, you know, there's going to be a civil war, there's going to be violence, there's going to be how do you deal with all that? How do you process it? Number one, do you think that things are as bad as people are thinking and feeling? And if so, how do you manage it?
I'll tell you, this is one of the best things about being older, because if you've lived through all the panics that turned out to be fake panics, then the new ones don't look real.
Okay.
So, you know, remember the, was it year 2000 bug?
Oh yeah, millennium bug.
Yeah. And everybody said, there's no way we're going to be able to fix that before everything, all the lights turn off. And for a year before that, I was saying, yeah, we will. We'll just figure out how to do it. We'll just probably figure out closer to the deadline, because that's just what we do. And then we'll fix it. And then the deadline came and everybody fixed it. And, you know, short of things like a world war, we're really good at fixing stuff. I mean, humans, oh my God, I'm so impressed with the human ability to take any problem and fix it. I mean, it's the only reason we're still here.
Yep, absolutely.
I mean, the fact that we survived and dominate the animal kingdom, I mean, in our opinion. The dogs have a different opinion of us. But we're real good adjusters and fixers. And I call it the Adams Law of Slow-Moving Disasters. Whenever you see a problem, or let's say society sees it, and you've got plenty of time, we always fix it. So you're going to run out of food. All right, we'll figure out how to grow more. Done. You're going to run out of oil. Well, we'll figure out how to frack. Okay. Well, there's no way we'll get enough lithium to build all these electric cars. Oh, it turns out there's plenty of lithium. Yeah, so it just keeps going like that. The ones you worry about are the pandemic types.
Okay.
It's like, wait a minute, people in China just are falling over in the streets? Like right now? What do we do? What do we do? And so that's why the pandemic was so poorly managed. It's just, we're not good when it's fast.
Yeah, so it's almost like the biggest threats to humanity are probably the ones that we're not even thinking about.
Like for sure.
Yeah, so if we're thinking about it and talking about it and doing podcasts on the topic, it's probably something that we'll manage to get a handle on and turn around, but it's the thing that's just going to pop out of nowhere.
Yeah, right. And the other thing is I have experience doing financial and other projections. Mm-hmm. I used to do that in my corporate world. And so I look at something like climate change, and they say, oh, it's a problem for the next whatever decades. That's a lot of time for humans to figure it out.
Yeah.
And I don't know what the solution will be, but there are probably 100 different ways it could go. It could be just we go hog wild on nuclear power and we make them modular and we build them in factories and they're pre-approved because it's the same package every time. And then 10 years from now, boom, almost free energy. Fusion. Fusion might be within 10 years. Finally, we always say that, right? but it looks real now.
Yeah,
I think it was maybe about several years ago. I actually had a conversation with Sam Altman, who's doing the AI stuff. And he had invested in fusion. And so this is a number of years ago. And he told me at the time that fusion has passed out of the science phase and is into the engineering phase. Mm-hmm. In other words, you've got to figure out how to build it, but all the principles have been proven. And as he pointed out, and I agree, that once you reach the engineering stage, it's guaranteed. So fusion went from, I don't know if we can do this, to it's now guaranteed. Mm-hmm. You don't know if it's 10 years, you don't know if it's 20, but when it reaches the engineering stage, it's going to happen. There's nothing to stop it.
That's interesting. I've never thought of that point before. Where do you see the future of this country going over the next couple of decades? Do you have any big predictions on that?
Well, you know, so much, the world has become unpredictable in a way that maybe never existed before, because AI will so fundamentally change everything, socially, the way we interact, all the entire economy, that I don't think anything's predictable beyond a year anymore.
Oh, wow.
I think 1 year is, and even that gets a little murky 12 months out. So I'm a perpetual optimist. I believe that we will figure out how to make AI an enormous positive. It will have problems.
Sure.
I don't think it's going to destroy the earth. I don't think that for a second. Mm-hmm. But only because we're going to be good at managing it. Because we all understand that this is the big risk. Mm-hmm. You know, this is the one. So I actually think that we're going to evolve into machine form, and we're just going to take our patterns and move them into machines, and that will be the future of human evolution.
Whoa. Okay, that's quite a prediction.
I also think it's closer to inevitable.
Yeah.
I think it just has to happen.
So do you think that Homo sapiens ceases to be in that sense and becomes something else, or
unless we keep a few of both?
Or I know. This is where I'm like, oh gosh, this is sounding.
No, probably not in our lifetimes.
Yeah,
but I'm already doing my end of days planning. I'm at that age, and already it's obvious that because the way the large language models are trained on existing bodies of work and books and stuff. And I have a lot of books. So the current model of, in fact, there was some news story about this that I was specifically listed as one of the authors whose work are now part of the patterns that will probably be living in AI forever. So in effect, my genes have been passed on.
Well, can you explain that a little more? Yeah.
Let's say if you're passing your genes on in a biological sense, you have a kid, but the kid only has, I'll just talk in approximate terms. Let's say it has half of your genes and half of your spouse.
Sure.
The next time that kid gets married, the next kid, diluted further. But your genes are in there. Mm-hmm. Likewise, AI will become some kind of a life force, if it isn't already, in the future. And it will be born with my genes. Other people too, the other authors, But if any of my ideas were stickier or they rose to the top because they just work better, such as the talent stack idea or systems being better than goals, then I become a permanent part of AI for all time. As long as those are good ideas.
Mm-hmm.
When they're not good ideas, then they would fade away.
That's interesting. Scott, what do you want your legacy to be?
Oh, that's really interesting. I don't believe in an afterlife, so I don't think of it in those terms. I think about sort of what I can do while I'm here. I don't know if I ever said this publicly, but I have a philosophy to live my life to have the biggest funeral. So I want people to come to my funeral because I did something for them. No other reason, mm-hmm. not because they've heard of Dilbert or something. I want people to say, you know what? I read his book. I tried his diet advice. I did something, mm-hmm. just anything. And he made my life better. And I'm going to take that forward, you know, teach my kids and stuff. That would be I want the biggest possible funeral.
Awesome, man. Well, Scott, your work has definitely made my life better. And I know it's done the same for millions of others. I do believe in the afterlife. And I hope we'll see you up there in a good place.
I'll see you there. Yeah. let's hope you're right. I'll see you there.
No doubt, man. But thank you so much for your time, man. I always appreciate your insights. You're one of my favorite thinkers out there in the world. It's fascinating being able to sit here and meet you in person for the first time because I've been aware of you since I was a child. And so it's pretty cool all these decades later to be able to sit down with the man himself and just talk face to face like this. It's an honor.
Well, you're too nice. I'm a huge fan of yours, as I said earlier, and it was great to meet you in person.
For the ones who work hard to ensure their crew can always go the extra mile, and the ones who get in early so everyone can go home on time, there's Grainger, offering professional-grade supplies backed by product experts so you can quickly and easily find what you need. Plus, you can count on access to a committed team ready to go the extra mile for you. Call, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
Save big money at Menards. Let the fresh air in and keep the bugs out with replacement screen for your doors and windows from AdForce. It's easy to install, durable against the elements, and comes in a variety of types to suit your needs. Repair your screens today with a roll of replacement screen on sale through May 5th. And check out more great deals happening now in our weekly flyer on Menards.com.
Save big.